Bars, tattoo parlors, and rodeos. What a return to normal is shaping up as in Texas. As Governor Abbott moves to the next stage in reopening, details today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. With support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. Reopening dates vary by industry, and rules aren't being relaxed everywhere at once. Tony Plohetsky of KVU and the Austin American Statesman spells it out. Also, is the U.S. government fast-tracking child deportations? Why are so many small businesses having trouble getting promised aid? And the Hill Country spider that caught the attention of the Texas Supreme Court. All those stories and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets started. Right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this 19th day of May, 2020. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. Hope your Tuesday's off to a good start. In a period that has brought many challenges and hardships, the New York Times yesterday suggested one way to deal with the anxieties of this era is to pause for a moment and count the joys that are out there. And there have been quite a few. Among them, getting to reconnect with old friends by phone, reaching out to family more frequently. It was in just such a catch-up call that I rang up my brother on Sunday. After the usual hellos, he startled me with an enthusiastic question I wasn't quite ready for. So they're building this Cybertruck in Austin, huh? Well, I hadn't heard that, but Ars Technica is reporting right now that Tulsa and Austin are among the finalists for a Tesla plant to build the Cybertruck and the new Model Y. Back in April, Elon Musk told shareholders that the location would be announced within 3 months, so that could mean an announcement could be coming soon. For what it's worth, Apple broke ground on a large Austin campus for more than 5,000 workers last year in the Texas capital city. Now, all this predates Musk's frustration with California's pace of reopening and his infamous Twitter fit of last week, but there are a growing number of celebs, including podcasting giant Joe Rogan, declaring such frustration with California's posture on reopening that they're thinking of coming to Texas, too. Needless to say, the eyes of many in the U.S. are on the Lone Star State right now as Governor Abbott commences his phased-in reopening plans, which we learned more about yesterday, and it is a complicated strategy. Here to help us break it all down, reporter Tony Plohetsky of KVU and the Austin American Statesman. Tony, good to have you back on the Standard.
Good morning. Hope you're doing well out there.
Likewise. Hey, listen, what's new in this latest round of reopenings?
You know, there's a lot going on with these reopenings. As you mentioned, it's really complicated in some ways. So I'm going to try to break it down as much as possible for people. But hang on tight, because you know, there are different things that are happening at different times. So immediately, beginning yesterday, childcare providers could reopen. Businesses and office buildings could reopen. Massage and tattoo services could reopen, and youth clubs like scouting groups could also begin meeting. Now, beginning Friday, we're going to see even more businesses begin to reopen. Bars, I know, have been a big topic of conversation for people. Bars can begin opening on Friday, but with a 25% capacity. And there are some additional rules and regulations about bar operations that are all contained in a handbook that the governor's office is providing. But a couple of examples is that loitering is not permitted at a bar. Dancing is not recommended at a bar, for example.
But I noticed, though, that bowling alleys are okay. A bingo hall, skating rinks, rodeos, and aquariums are going to be reopening on Friday, too.
Exactly, yeah. Yes.
Zoos will be reopening at 25% capacity on May 29th. And on May 31st, I think a lot of parents are eager to hear about this. Those youth camps, many open for the summer, will be reopening. And Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick has been talking about getting America back to playing ball again. It looks like professional sports venues will be allowed to open on May 31st as well, right?
Yeah, and it's my understanding that they will actually, professional teams will actually have to go through an application process with the state before they can begin playing. Of course, those sports will not be allowed to have live spectators on the premises to watch the events, but the events themselves can take place.
Although we should note that the governor did concede that the latest round of reopenings will be coming a week later in places around El Paso and Amarillo, where there have been recent outbreaks of COVID-19. Did he have anything to say about the fact that we have seen spikes in the number of coronavirus cases in Texas since the reopening?
He's got plenty to say about that. Number one, what the governor has said as part of his narrative about reopening Texas is that, yes, the number of positive cases has spiked, but you have to overlay that with the amount of testing, the volume of testing that has gone on. I mean, according to the governor, of course, it is pure logic that the more people you test, the more positive tests you're going to get. But the governor in his news conference yesterday, and he has said this previously, but he provided even more information about the things that he is really evaluating and putting his stock in. One is the amount of hospitalizations, the amount of beds that are being used in hospitals, and he's still pretty pleased by that. But the other thing with regard to testing is that he is monitoring the rate of positive testing. So in other words, what percentage of people who go in for tests are testing positive. Mm-hmm. And it is true that in recent weeks, we have seen that number, you know, go down somewhat. But at times we've gone from maybe 6% to 5%, now just below 5% into the 4% range. That is one of the things that he says really does indicate that the spread of the virus is really increasingly being contained across the state. The governor also points out that in some areas of Texas, particularly where there are meat packing facilities and other types of businesses where we have seen clusters of cases, that is also contributing to a higher number of positive COVID-19 cases in those counties.
Tony Plohetsky is a reporter with the Austin American-Statesman and KVU-TV, which is Austin's ABC affiliate. Tony, good to have you back on the broadcast. Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much.
The U.S. government's been fast-tracking the deportation of child migrants during the coronavirus pandemic. That according to a new report from the Texas Tribune ProPublica Investigative Unit. Critics have claimed that the Trump administration is using the global health crisis as a pretext to advance an objective of shutting down the U.S.-Mexico border against migrants altogether. Loemi Creel is a reporter on this story, and she joins us now. Loemi, good to have you back on the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Your report says the U.S. government's rushing child deportations during the coronavirus pandemic. How are they doing so, and what's their reasoning behind these deportations?
So what we know is that since March, attorneys say there seems to have been an escalation in trying to deport some of these children, particularly children who came to the U.S. border with their parents, and under a U.S. program known as the Migrant Protection Protocols, were made to wait in Mexico for their asylum case. And so after waiting, there's sort of myriad issues with that program, and many families had to wait for a long time. And a lot of parents ended up sending their children across alone, or parents left, or something happened to the parents. So children came by themselves. And now they have this old case with their families, and potentially a new case as unaccompanied children coming by themselves. And it appears the government is trying to kind of fast track those children.
But these children now, when they're apprehended by U.S. officials, they are what, being flown back to their country of origin? What exactly is happening to these children?
So when children cross alone, they're apprehended and they're placed in the care of the Office of Refugee Resettlement, mm-hmm. which keeps them in federal shelters or foster care while they figure out sort of how to either reunify them with their families or what to do. And then ICE is the agency that then, if they have a deportation order, that then does remove them and, yes, flies them back to their countries of origin. And if they have family there, you know, and then that sort of is up to the consulate to figure out where they go from there.
I want to get a sort of a mental image of this, because when we use the word children, we're really talking about minors, people under 18, I would imagine. Are the majority of these teenagers, are they just little toddlers that are crossing the border? What is going on? Can you paint that picture for us?
Well, the two girls that I focus on in my story were 8 and 11, and they had come with their father from El Salvador after fleeing threats from gangs there. Their mother had come to Houston, and they were waiting in Matamoros across from Brownsville for their asylum case when their father went missing one day. He just didn't come back from work in Matamoros. He had been assaulted and left on the side of the road. And so a neighbor took the little girls to the border and said they should cross and go look for their mom in Houston. And those children were placed in a federal shelter, according to U.S. regulation, and were almost approved to be reunited with their mom when at the absolute last moment, almost, her attorney says, ICE suddenly notified them that they were going to deport them to El Salvador, where these girls have no family left.
What are the immigration advocates you've spoken with proposing as an alternative for the U.S.?
Well, they're saying that these children should be not considered as part of their family's cases in Mexico and that sort of problematic program there, but that they should just have a new bid for asylum as part of being unaccompanied children, which is a legal term that affords children far more protections than adults or if they come with families. And so they're just saying these children should just have those rights afforded to them, basically.
We're going to link to this story over at texasstandard.org. Loemi Creel is a reporter for the Texas Tribune ProPublica Investigative Unit. Loemi, thanks again.
Thanks so much for having me.
He's back in the saddle, Wells Dunbar, social media editor. Good to have you back, Wells.
Good to be back, David. Thanks for that. We're hearing about the Governor Greg Abbott and his reopening orders from our friends and listeners. Those orders we recapped at the top, allowing bars to reopen in a diminished capacity this Friday, increasing restaurant capacity, and allowing childcare centers to reopen as of today. On our Facebook page, Jerry Harp says it had to be done, but the odds of a resurgence are high considering there's no mandatory precautions. Jerry adds that mandatory wearing of masks in public and a continued degree of social distancing would allow for a safe reopening, but no, instead, the governor's pandering to a small portion of folks on the right. Expect another devastating shutdown as hospitals become overwhelmed, he predicts. Matt Weiss says this about the reopening of bars, noting that they aren't the type of place you go to maintain a 6-foot radius from other people. Now, when it comes to restaurants, Tyler Malloy says he'll be dining out when the governor's mansion opens up for tours again. Just some of the reactions we're seeing out there, David. I'll be back with more from social later in the show.
We'd love to know what you think about this story or anything else that you're hearing out there in Texas. You know what to do. Look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. And our social media editor, Wells Dunbar, will be back with more of your comments in 35.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. We were talking about Governor Abbott's new orders to open bars on Friday, but in Abilene, a bar called the Whiskey Girl opened Monday night, 4 days before the governor's orders are supposed to take effect. KACU's Heather Claiborne has more.
Governor Greg Abbott's phase two for reopening the state's economy allows bars to resume operation at 25% capacity on Friday, but that's not soon enough for Koi Chu. Chu announced on Facebook yesterday that the Whiskey Girl in Abilene was exhausted and he was unable to wait another week. He says his payroll was too low to qualify for the Paycheck Protection Program, and after an initial confirmation for the Economic Injury Disaster Loan, he never heard anything else. Chu says recently he had to get a second job selling cars.
I put my 401k, I mean literally my life savings, into opening a bar. And I've had it for 7 years and done well. Finally, after 7 years, you start building enough regulars and a crowd and a name. And to have that just taken away overnight was insane.
The Whiskey Girl has a capacity of 200 inside and 40 on the patio. He had someone counting patrons at the door last night, trying to keep the total below 50.
The last thing we want to do is upset anybody. We're not trying to make the city mad or TABC mad. This really just came down to having to pay bills.
In an email, Abilene City Manager Robert Hanna said after consulting with the city attorney, they would not be sending the police to enforce the governor's order. He noted, however, that bars receive their licenses from the state of Texas and are at risk of losing their license or facing fines for not following Abbott's order. I'm Heather Claiborne.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, providing community relief actions for the COVID-19 crisis, including early dividend distribution to eligible policyholders. More at texasmutual.com/dividends.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. It's time to face the fact that PPP didn't work, so says billionaire and Dallas Mavericks owner Mark Cuban. He's speaking on Twitter about the Paycheck Protection Program, that program for small loans to businesses. The Small Business Administration, the SBA, doled out $349 billion in less than 2 weeks, followed up by another $310 billion. But this hasn't proven to be a whole lot of help for many of the 1,787,000 small businesses in Texas, almost 80% of which have no employees. Here to help us understand why it's been so difficult to help small business, Maria Watson. She is Research Assistant Professor in Urban Planning at Texas A&M University. Professor Watson, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Hi, happy to be here.
I think a lot of people heard these stories that you are also writing about some of these larger organizations, Shake Shack, Potbelly, the L.A. Lakers, getting millions of dollars in loans as mom and pop stores continued to struggle. Is that emblematic of what's been going wrong, that some of those organizations that were not really the target of these loans initially reached out and did what they weren't supposed to do?
Well, I think it's natural for all businesses to want assistance. I think all kinds of businesses are struggling in this pandemic. But yes, it tends to be that the larger businesses are more successful in getting the loans. Very small businesses are operating on very small profit margins. Loans can be intimidating for them in terms of taking on additional debt. They don't have the cash reserves like larger businesses to weather this economic uncertainty in terms of when customers are going to come back. And they generally have fewer ways of accessing financing and having existing bank loans and banking relationships.
But I thought that that was something that these small business loans were intended to fix, that there was an understanding that small businesses face these unique challenges. Why didn't the money get down to those, as we were saying earlier, mom and pop stores?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. These programs are pretty new. Usually, disaster loans have been physical disaster loans. This PPP program, of course, is very new. And one of the new parts about it is this kind of mediating relationship with the bank. So businesses that have relationships with banks or have, you know, a banker that they can go see have tended to fare better because they have that that relationship. And smaller businesses are less likely to have existing loans and existing banking relationships. And so some banks have been reluctant to take on new customers in this case.
Is that fair, though? I mean, isn't the idea that that the government was going to make an extraordinary effort to try to lift small businesses so they wouldn't go under, not just preserve the large businesses that have access to other lines of credit?
Yes, it does seem very counterintuitive to, I think also what the community wants. I mean, the community wants the small businesses in their communities as well. So I think everyone wants to see these small businesses succeed.
Well, what's interesting is that you have done quite a bit of research on disasters in Texas, and you found that, in a sense, this isn't that unusual, that smaller organizations have long struggled to get aid after a crisis. Take us back to 2008 and Hurricane Ike. What did you find?
Yes, that's correct. The same thing happened after Hurricane Ike, where smaller businesses did tend to struggle to get assistance from SBA in their disaster loan program. And this is for a lot of reasons. Again, the approval rate was only around 22% for businesses that successfully got their applications in. A lot of the declines happened because of unsatisfactory credit or lack of repayment ability. But that's actually not capturing the businesses that couldn't even make it through the application process. So a lot of businesses found the application process to be difficult, burdensome. The paperwork was just very difficult for businesses to get through.
As I was reading up on this, I was surprised to learn that almost 80% of what are termed small businesses in Texas are, in fact, basically operations with no employees beyond the owner. Is that an obstacle here?
Oh, yes, definitely. That leads to an interesting point that the Small Business Administration defines small businesses as fewer than 500 employees. But that's actually very large. As you're saying, most of the businesses in Texas are either, sole proprietorships, have zero employees, or have even fewer than 20 or 10 employees. And so, there's even a discrepancy in what we see as a small business.
But what surprises me is that shouldn't we have learned from past disasters, or for that matter, from the Great Recession, that if you really want to help small businesses, you've got to do away with some of those concerns about cash flow and repayment, especially when specifically this is designed to forgive repayment if you're helping employees.
Yeah, and I think that this forgivable loan is moving in the right direction. I think having the option to forgive loans is a great step for helping small businesses. But it's a new program, and we're seeing that a lot of businesses are still unable to meet the requirements for forgivable loans. We're still seeing kind of these strict requirements. Moving towards being a little bit more forgiving, both in terms of the loan, as well as the requirements for small businesses, will really help us moving forward in future disasters and helping small businesses.
Maria Watson is research assistant professor in urban planning at Texas A&M University. We'll link to her editorial over at texasstandard.org. Professor Watson, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Well, the coronavirus has claimed yet another Texas-based retailer, and this is a big one. Fort Worth-based Pier 1 Imports was in financial trouble before the pandemic, and executives hoped to find a buyer to rescue it, but that never happened thanks in large part to the coronavirus crimp on money. Instead, Pier 1 will start liquidating its inventory as soon as it can reopen its 900 stores, including 53 in Texas. An auction for any remaining assets will be held on July 8th, coming up on 29 Minutes Past the Hour.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. The Texas Supreme Court says evictions can resume today after temporarily halting proceedings in response to the coronavirus outbreak. But as KUT's Audrey McGlinchey reports, some federal and local regulations extend the ban on evictions well into the summer.
As part of the federal government's CARES Act, some renters are protected from eviction until late August. This includes renters living in federally subsidized buildings or rental situations, such as Section 8 vouchers, or complexes financed by what's called low-income tax credits. Also, any building with a mortgage backed by a federal loan, such as Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. If you live in the city of Austin, the mayor has halted evictions until after July 25th. You also get 60 days to come up with unpaid rent before a landlord can file an eviction. There's a similar rule in the city of San Marcos, where a tenant gets 90 days to come up with unpaid rent before a landlord can start an eviction.
Audrey McGlinchey reporting. Researchers with the University of Texas at Austin are projecting daily fatalities from COVID-19 in the state are likely to peak by early June, if not sooner. The latest forecast is based on cell phone location data to determine how much Texans have been social distancing in public places such as parks, restaurants, and hospitals. Dr. Lauren Ansel Myers leads the UT COVID-19 Modeling Consortium.
We project that for the state of Texas as a whole, there's probably a 65% chance we've already passed our peak mortality for this first wave. And it's very likely that we will have passed our peak within 2 weeks.
Dr. Myers stresses the model is based on sustained social distancing behavior over the next few weeks. The statewide death toll climbed to 1,347 on Monday. A Houston billionaire wants the Trump administration to make small business relief loans available to larger corporations. Tilman Fertitta is the CEO of Landry's, which operates hundreds of restaurants. Fertitta, who also owns the Houston Rockets, attended a roundtable on the restaurant industry at the White House Monday. He told the president he returned funds he received through the Federal Paycheck Protection Program due to public criticism.
I took the money and sent it back and did not spend a dollar of it.
A number of large companies returned loans they received through the COVID-19 aid program after facing backlash. Fertitta says while only companies with 500 or fewer employees are eligible for the funding, each of his individual restaurants is below that threshold. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the online UT High School, offering a full-time diploma program and individual courses for students from any school. Courses can be started anytime to catch up or get ahead. Learn more at highschool.utexas.edu.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Thousands of asylum seekers continue to wait in Mexico under the Trump administration's Remain in Mexico policy, which requires them to remain there for months as their asylum cases unfold in U.S. immigration court. Medical experts at a migrant camp in Matamoros worry that COVID-19 could spread like wildfire if the virus lands in there. Texas Public Radio's Ronaldo Leaños Jr. reports new help has arrived at the camp to protect against the virus.
Esta va a ser el hospital para los pacientes de COVID.
Dr. Dairon Elizondo Rojas shows me around a new 20-bed tented hospital at the end of the camp. He's a volunteer here, and he's also an asylum seeker from Cuba. We stand on a tarp-like floor surrounded by medical equipment, COVID antibody tests, and cardiac monitors. This tent is reserved for COVID-19 patients. For now, it's unused because there are no positive cases. Dairon says this small tent is a game changer. It arrived about 2 weeks ago, after they tried for several weeks to get the equipment into Matamoros.
No te voy a decir que no de miedo, porque da miedo saber que te vas a enfrentar a una situación que...
He'd be lying if he said he wasn't scared, facing something that has killed nurses and doctors around the world. But he says it's a job they chose, and if they don't help people here at the camp, who else will?
Currently, we have not had any patients that we have admitted.
Helen Perry is the executive director of Global Response Management, GRM, a nonprofit that provides health services.
We have two patients that we went ahead and had isolated due to their symptoms, and they were tested by the government. And so we're keeping them in isolation until those results come back, just out of an abundance of caution.
She says the majority of COVID-19 cases in Matamoros originated near the camp, and the fact that they haven't had any positive cases at the camp is a testament to their safety measures. GRM has 5 full-time staff members, but they want to provide more services.
We've worked in 7 countries, Iraq, Yemen, Syria, Bangladesh, the Bahamas, and now Mexico. It's not that we don't have the capabilities. It's not that we don't have the volunteers. It is simply funding. These things all take money.
In her experience, countries from where refugees are fleeing from and fleeing to often provide some sort of financial support. That's not happening here. An outbreak can come at any moment. She says it happens at other refugee camps.
With things like typhoid or cholera, there are vaccines for those diseases. And so, you know, your response is often very different because at the first sign of there being an outbreak, you start aggressively addressing the need for vaccinations. You know, COVID doesn't have a vaccination.
Another precaution that's taking place at the camp is that there's now a strong presence of the Mexican National Guard and federal police.
One of the goals is to prevent just random locals from coming into the camp so that they can provide a little bit more security.
The Mexican government also put up a fence that circles part of the camp.
You know, fences are a pro and a con, right? Like they keep people out. They also keep people in. I mean, it's an intimidating sight when, you know, this big 12-foot fence goes up with Constantina wire. I think that that's something that we're continuing to monitor.
Helen was told by Mexican officials that there will be no restriction of movement for the migrants. Near the new fence, There's a small room where three women help protect the camp from the virus. Carmen is an asylum seeker from Honduras. She sits at the sewing machine, cranking out face masks for other migrants. She says she likes to help when she can. She would sew back home, but never made face masks before. They've made about 100 masks this week. Some of the nonprofits that work in the area donated cloth, sewing machines, and wages for the workers. Volunteers say the camp continues to shelter more than 1,500 people and that they'll do everything they can to stop the virus from entering the camp, as COVID is expected to hit its peak in Mexico this summer. I'm Reynaldo Leaños Jr. in Matamoros.
Well, new computers are headed to Houston area families in need. Local charity CompuDopt says it has begun distributing free laptops to low-income families with school kids to help with distance learning. Since coronavirus began spreading rapidly across Texas in March, schools have canceled in-person classes and many have shifted to distance learning, but lack of access to computers can be a barrier for needy families, obviously. CompuDopt says interest in the program has been overwhelming. Between 3,000 and 5,000 families each day are vying for 60 available reservations released daily for those computers. Coming up on 39 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time is a whole lot more of the standard just ahead. Stick around.
Support for Texas Standard comes from White Mountain Bulgarian Yogurt, family owned and operated in Austin, Texas for 40 years. Learn about the value of eating traditional Bulgarian yogurt at whitemountainfoods.com, available in the dairy aisle. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
This is the Texas Standard, and I'm Annie Silverstein. I'm a writer and director based in Austin.
Crystal's been causing me some grief.
You'd be in bed.
Well, I was a youth worker for 10 years before deciding to go to film school. And so when I began writing the story, I was certainly drawing on that time in my life as a youth worker. That, you know, one of the central characters in the story, her mom is incarcerated.
Well, you ain't doing your job, miss.
I'm doing my best. Please. Her mom is in jail. I'm sorry for what she did. Is there any way we can work this out?
And then we met a man from a black cowboy family.
You see that bull? You think he's just going crazy, right?
Who shared with us his history and the story of his family. And just meeting him inspired us to dig deeper into that history and culture and start going to backyard rodeos. And I didn't set off to write this exact story at first. I just became interested in this intersection between this adolescent girl and this aging bullfighter.
That's the girl that broke into your house?
Hey, I bet she can ride better than you.
He's bullfighting at the PBR.
Welcome to the 25th anniversary of the toughest sport on dirt!
But after a big injury, you know, these bullfighters sustain so many injuries in their career, he is basically pushed out of his role there.
Well, the report said that you blacked out.
And so he goes back to his roots. And so, you know, in the film you'll see rodeo scenes at PBR, which is like the NFL of rodeo, but you'll also see these rodeo scenes that are in Texas, in Egypt, Texas, at Old William Johnson Arena. We also worked with the oldest black rodeo in Oklahoma, and it was important to us that was a part of the story, as far as wanting to expand people's understanding about the West and who's included in that.
But when he gets close to you, he closes his eyes. He can't see. And then he's yours. You understand?
You know, oftentimes we talk about coming-of-age stories and we just are talking about teenagers, but we saw this as a dual coming-of-age story because we feel like we actually come of age many times in our lives.
She wants to be a bull rider now.
A bull rider, huh?
You ain't gonna make no money in bull riding.
You wanna make some money, we can talk about that.
And so with all the rodeo scenes, you can't control a bull. You can't control what's going to happen. We very much approached them almost like a documentary, as far as having our stunt double, who's a, you know, real bullfighter. He would go off and bullfight, and we would film him doing his work. And then right in between rides, we would have gotten the permission from the rodeo to run our actor in. And so, of course, these scenes were scripted, but we also knew that things would happen that we would then have to react to. And we had to be fluid and kind of do rewriting in the moment to make it work. I'm Annie Silverstein, and I'm a writer and director living in Austin, and you're listening to the Texas Standard.
It's Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Blooming flowers, chirping birds, and buzzing bees. Springtime in Texas. But during the coronavirus pandemic, against a backdrop of rising unemployment and daily case counts, the vibrant season of growth and rebirth takes on a new meaning for many folks, as KERA's Elizabeth Mayong discovered.
When Catherine Leal Unmuth walks her dog along the Santa Fe Trail in Dallas, she pauses to admire the birds and wildflowers in bloom. Seeing spring in action has helped her keep things in perspective during the coronavirus epidemic.
It's just appreciating beauty and appreciating life and being thankful for that.
Unmuth works as a public relations manager at a Dallas law firm. She also serves on the board of the Friends of Santa Fe Trail. She takes pictures for the trail's Instagram account. A recent post featured a red and yellow-rimmed fire wheel covered with dew. Unmuth has many favorites.
Right now, there are a lot of pink evening primrose wildflowers, purple prairie verbena, the blue bonnets I've noticed.
Robin Koretsky is a legal assistant in Dallas, and she says the simple act of looking at or smelling a flower can be powerful.
It brings you into basics, into nature.
She also finds a kind of camaraderie among the butterflies and bees as they enjoy the flowers alongside her.
They're doing their thing to touch down and experience and you know, pick up the pollen or the whatever it is that attracts them to that particular flower.
Koretsky recently went to a quiet bluebonnet road in Dallas to admire the Texas state flower in its springtime glory.
I was literally able to pull over on the road, roll down the window, snap a few photos of the bluebonnets, and then, you know, head on from there.
Koretsky said she recognizes the irony of this situation, that the quarantine has both hindered and intensified her love for spring. Still, she's thankful for the time to enjoy the flourishing world around her. She says coronavirus has also given nature an unexpected gift, time to grow mostly untouched by humans, unlike last spring.
You'd see people, you know, doing their pictures and like plopping down and squashing the bluebonnets.
Nature's not just showing off right now with vibrant floral displays, but with birds too, like these in a Richardson neighborhood. Their chirping becomes nature's springtime symphony. Daniel Cunningham is a Dallas-based horticulturalist with Texas A&M AgriLife. Despite the pandemic, he says we should take time to listen to the birds, to admire the wildlife, and to appreciate the beauty of the bluebonnets, paintbrushes, and buttercups that are decorating fields and parks across North Texas.
Just taking as much time as you can to spend outside, I think, is a great way to recharge our batteries and just to kind of to break away for even if it's just a moment and enjoy nature.
The next wildflower North Texans can look forward to? The sunflower, perhaps one of the most universal symbols of hope and strength. It'll be in bloom throughout the summer. Koretsky said this year's spring is certainly different than last year's, but the flowers blooming on cue, regardless of the uncertain world around them, brings back happy memories.
It can make you go back to positive times. It makes you reflect on where I was last April.
Koretsky said in the chaos of the coronavirus pandemic, the sprouting shoots and unfurling petals serve as a gentle reminder. Like the seasons, this too shall pass. I'm Elizabeth Mayong in Dallas.
Well, a once familiar name in Texas beer is getting a makeover. Pearl Beer was first brewed in San Antonio back in the 1880s, but the brewery closed in 2001. Now we hear that Pabst Brewing Company owns the recipe and is going to start making a new version of Pearl with a citrusy twist. Pabst is contracting with an Austin area brewery to make it. It's supposed to hit store shelves in San Antonio this month and go statewide in June. Wonder what Doug Somm would think. You Doug heads probably understand. We're coming up on 49 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. More of the talk of Texas is just around the corner. Stay with us.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, whose fight against cancer includes telemedicine. At-home, virtual visits with doctors help patients keep appointments while continuing to practice safe social distancing. Learn more at TexasOncology.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at RandGroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
It's Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. The itsy bitsy spider went up the waterspout and ended up all the way in the Texas Supreme Court building. Gather around, kids, for a tale involving a woodsy cabin at a Fredericksburg bed and breakfast, a venomous brown recluse, a bite, and this question. Whether the owner of the property had a duty to warn of that itsy bitsy spider. Oh, what a tangled web we have here. To help us untangle it a bit, Tiffany Lashmet. She is an attorney and extension specialist with Texas A&M, podcaster and author of the Texas Agriculture Law Blog. Tiffany, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about the basic facts here. First, Homer Hillis owns a property out in the Hill Country that has a cabin on it. And this was leased to one Henry McCall, as I understand it.
That's right.
Now, what did Homer Hillis fail to do, according to Henry McCall?
So Mr. McCall, actually, there were a couple of different cabins on the property. Mr. Mm-hmm. McCall went over to the cabin he did not live in to open it up for guests coming that weekend. When he did that, he reached into a cabinet under a sink and was bit by this brown recluse spider. And his legal allegation was that Mr. Hillis failed to warn him of the spider that he knew or should have known about.
Okay. Now, did Homer Hillis indeed know that there were brown recluse spiders in that cabin?
There was no knowledge of brown recluse spiders in the cabin or even specifically on the property. He did say that he knew they could exist in the Hill Country.
Well, what about Henry McCall? Surely he must know that out in the woods in Texas, you're going to come across some of these brown recluses.
Well, and this was a big issue in the case. And one thing there that you're pointing out is spot on. He could have known about or even seen the spider that day just as easy as Mr. Hillis could have. So in other words, it wasn't like a hidden condition that he needed to be warned about.
Well, let's talk about some of the general principles here before we get to the actual finding. When we invite someone onto our property, I think a lot of us know that there is a general duty to warn of known conditions that could be dangerous. Like, say, I don't know, watch out for that pothole in the backyard, that kind of thing, right?
That's right. Yes. And it's a little more nuanced than that, just because depending on if you have an invitee or a licensee on the property. Mm-hmm. But in general, your statement's right. If you know of a dangerous condition that may be hidden, you've got a duty to warn people about that.
All right. So let's say then some wild hog roams onto our property. Now, we in Texas know that these wild hogs are out there. What about that wild hog and the duty to warn that there might be wild hogs in the area?
Sure. Now, there's a little twist when we talk about that duty to warn, and that's a doctrine that says when you're dealing with wild animals like hogs, snakes, spiders, you do not have a duty to warn someone of those animals, subject to three pretty narrow exceptions. If you brought the wild animal in from somewhere else to the property, you can be liable. That doesn't happen very often. Second exception is if you have reduced that animal to your control. So I guess if you had a pet feral hog, we could have the situation. Okay.
Uh-huh.
And the third exception is the one that was at issue in this case. And that is if the animal is in an artificial structure, should the owner known or should have known about that spider? And was it a hidden danger from the other person?
Was it a hidden danger from the other person? Which brings us back to what the lessee in this case, Homer Hills, knew or should have known, I guess.
That's right. What the landowner knew or should have known was the question. And then the other question is, was this a latent or hidden dangerous condition?
I see. All right. So how did the Texas Supreme Court ultimately come down here?
So the Texas Supreme Court in this case came down on the side of the landowner. They basically said, listen, it was a wild animal. Even though it was in an artificial structure, there's no evidence, number one, that the landowner knew about the spider or really should have known. And since it wasn't something that was hidden, right, it was not something that the injured party could have seen himself, then there was just no duty that was owed or breached in this case.
Wow. Well, that I would think that this was quite a victory for people who own or lease property to others, right? This kind of lessens the duty, or am I reading that wrong?
I'm not sure that it lessens the duty, but I think that it's a good example of how this duty is applied. And we didn't have that many cases involving artificial structures and wild animals, so I think that it just sort of expanded on our understanding of that duty.
As a result of this ruling, how can owners protect themselves?
You know, there are a number of things that owners can do. I think the most important thing is that every landowner needs to make sure that they have liability insurance that covers every activity going on the property.
Tiffany Lashmet is an attorney extension specialist, podcaster, and author of the Texas Agriculture Law Blog. Thank you so much for getting us to the moral of this story, Tiffany.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. An itsy-bitsy spider, and you end up with a new precedent in Texas law. Joining us once again, we have Wells Dunbar, social media editor. What you seeing out there, Wells?
Hey, David. Well, perhaps unsurprisingly, we're continuing to hear about the governor's new business reopening orders. We've been talking about this. Bars permitted to open in a limited capacity on Friday. Restaurant capacity expanding. Christian Hannon on Facebook, she says, all the people freaking out still have the right to stay inside. Let people make their own decision. Meanwhile, James Howard says he wonders how bars will stay in business at that 25% maximum occupancy rule. He writes that I could see more bars charging a cover just to get in and limiting people to two or three drinks to get people in and out faster. So truly, again, sort of begging this question of whether or not businesses will reopen now that they have the capacity to reopen.
Yeah.
Well, moving on to an egregious lack of social distancing, a video showcasing some news from Southeast Texas has gone viral. I don't know if you've had a chance to see this, but Beaumont, Texas 12 News Now, they ran a report about this thing called Go Topless Weekend in the Galveston area. It's an annual Jeeps on the Beach Bacchanal, the topless referring there to the Jeeps, I imagine. A Twitter user, Maria Rendon, she shared this video clip from the news and racked up some 12,000 retweets in the process. She tweeted, not even SNL could write something as ridiculous as this actual real news report from my local station. And believe it or not, David, I actually have a clip. Our engineer Casey's going to cue it up right now. Let's listen to that clip.
And beachgoers like Chelsea Collier are still taking precautions to stay safe.
Wash them hands for 20 seconds and keep them clean with the Germex. Totally.
Yes, the sound of a new viral star being born there, as tens of thousands of people have had the chance to see that clip.
The sharing common sense wisdom, obviously.
Yes, exactly. But it wasn't all fun and games. 12 News Now reports that over 140 people were arrested over the weekend there. Two people were shot and airlifted to the hospital. So, unfortunately, David, in a sense, this actually signals somewhat of a return to normal. Similar arrests in the triple digits have graced Go Topless Weekend last year. So some truly stunning stuff as the order prohibiting gatherings on Texas beaches has gone by the wayside there.
Clearly, it's not just the virus that you got to be on the lookout for on occasion. I mean,
no, sir.
What gatherings you're going to, I suppose.
No, sir. That's one story we're continuing to watch, hearing from lots of folks about that on our Twitter page where we have shared the video, and several more stories on our Facebook page. Just continuing to monitor things as they develop and what we're going to see moving forward with this latest phase two of reopenings in Texas.
Alas, we're out of time for the big broadcast, but you can keep up with everything going on Texas-wide over at texasstandard.org. We'll be back here tomorrow. Hope you can join us.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family.